22nd seconds.
Well, good evening, everybody. It's time for us to open our Bibles together to dig into the text of Judges. Once again, I hope everyone has their galoshes on, their rubber boots, maybe a hazmat suit, whatever you feel necessary to participate in the Bible study this evening. Jared, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing just dandy. We are wrapping up the school year. I'm trying to manage 200 students taking tests and getting, you know, stuff all messed up with Canvas and transitioning all those things. But we're almost there. We're in dead week now. I'm going to get everything finished graded and finals up for next week. And then it's just a race to the finish.
I'm sure that's going to be a big relief for you. I know the students will be happy to be through what is their own version of a micro dumpster fire for the end of their academic year. We've got quite a bit to cover tonight. We're going to try to cover the entire story of Abimelech, the boy who would be king, and see some of the interactions in the text, some of the instruction that God gives us through this message. Before we get any further, though, Jared, would you lead us in prayer to start our study?
Sure. Eternal God, open our lips that our mouths may declare your glory. Help us as we study your word to teach your truths, to learn of your character, and to become more like you. It is in Jesus Christ's name that we pray. Amen.
Amen. So we've got a couple of things to take place kind of as the where were we before we got to here side of things, the backstory, the prologue, and just as some simple reminders to introduce this. We're going to read chapter 9, verses 1 through 5 in a second to continue to tell that story, to tell that tale. But remember, we're looking at Abimelech. Abimelech, whose name has deep significance, obviously, in his connection to his daddy, his father, Gideon, who is familiar to us, and how that implies his setting and background. But in addition to that, we've got some other details, too. So I think what we can read right now, and then we can kind of break down who Abimelech is. So if you're opening your Bibles, you're going to be in chapter 9, verse 1, and we're going to read all the way through the fifth verse for right now. Now Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem to his mother's relatives and said to them and to the whole clan of his mother's family, say in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that one rule over you? Remember also that I am your bone and your flesh. And his mother's relatives spoke all these words on his behalf in the ears of all the leaders of Shechem, and their hearts inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, he is our brother. And they gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows who followed him. And he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the sons of Jerubbaal, 70 men on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest brother of Jerubbaal, was left, for he hid himself. All right, Jared, let's focus in on the text here and see if we can dig into some good insights. So what do we have going on?
Well, like you said, put on your hazmat suit because this one starts out just full throttle and none of it's good. So at the end of Gideon's story last time, we read that Gideon, who says he doesn't want to be king, is going to set himself up to be king, right? I mean, he has a kingly harem, right, with a bunch of wives and concubines. He has a bunch of kids, right, 70 sons here. And he names his son, my daddy is the king, but it's not okay enough for him to just have his father be king. He wants to be king, right? It's like the Lion King. I just can't wait to be king. Here, though, the problem is Gideon has kind of set things up as a house rule where he's going to kind of divide the situation among all of his sons. At least that seems to be the expectations going on. But that's not enough for Abimelech. His mom's a concubine, which means, you know, a lot of times we hear concubine, we think like mistress or prostitute. That's not what it is. It just means a second-class wife. It means her children cannot inherit property. They can get gifts. They can have positions of power, but they can't inherit property. And that's not enough for this guy. He doesn't want just property. He wants it all. So he's going to go to a really important place in the narratives of the Bible. He's going to go to Shechem. Now, you just taught Joshua. So what's going on with Shechem and Joshua?
So Shechem is both an entry and an exit to the story of Israel's occupation of the Promised Land. If you remember the story of Joshua, they went up the story of Israel there that Joshua text kind of narrows down to. They had bounced off of the Canaanite region the first time. The spies went in, they didn't go in, so they spent their 40 years wandering. They finally get up to Shechem. In the process of all of this cycling through, there's a lot of conflict, all the wars. Chapter 24, the close of Joshua, is the second kind of appearance of Shechem in the story. And that's where Joseph's bones are. That's where the final speeches of Joshua have their centerpiece. It becomes also a spot where there's beginning and endings of idolatry. There's beginning and endings of worship to Jehovah. It's kind of like going to a spot of deep spiritual significance for his personal history and saying, this is important. This is the big thing. I'm going to say something huge right now, like a speech would be in the Capitol Mall area.
Yeah, and we remember in 24, right, they make a covenant, and Joshua calls the people. He says, you know, the famous line, as for me and for my house, we're going to serve the Lord. But the whole time he's saying, you guys aren't going to. You're saying that you will, but you won't. And we see that right here because they're going to go to Shechem, right? They're going to go to Shechem. And we see that where are they going to get these 70 coins, these 70 weight of silver from? They're going to get it from the house of Baal Berit or Baal Berit. And that means the Baal of the covenant. Who are they? Who did they cut a covenant with? It wasn't with the Lord. It's Shechem. It's with Baal.
Yeah.
And we're going to see that the wages of serving Baal are death. And that's going to, from the very beginning until the very end of this story, the idolatry that they have, having turned the altar of what should be to God to Baal, is going to get a bunch of people killed.
Yeah, I think there's also a couple of quick tie-in points. Think about a boy who would be king, who is going to build his first army out of the rabble he finds. Spoiler alert, that happens again. By the way, if you really want to see the boy who would be king comes to full storytelling fruition, remember that second boy who would be a king has to go find his sword first before he becomes king, much like modern interpretations of the Arthur mythology take place. That's kind of a structure that takes place here, that this guy has to go prove himself, in essence, in some ways, that he's worthy to his leadership, and he's selling himself far beyond who he really is. This interaction with his mother's kinfolk, the way it's presented to us, very small portion of the larger reality that would have taken place, is kind of ridiculous. You know, like, what's better? But that's the point, I think, is that it is ridiculous that Abimelech, who has a name like that, my daddy's the king, is the one that they really want to be king as the next phase of their existence. And we see some shiftiness, if you will, in their response later down the road. So what else is going on here? I think we've got a stepping stone that kind of moves into his rise. Like, how does he actually secure his kingship?
Well, he's going to secure his kingship like you kind of referenced in the same way, similar as David does at first, is he's going to hire a bunch of disenfranchised hooligans, right, who are sellswords, mercenaries. And he's like, hey, what if we just had a military coup? And we see something here, too, and that is that and all the stories before here, especially the beginning of Gideon and backwards, the enemies are the Canaanites. That's who the conflict's with. But starting here, and in this story, just like at the end of Gideon's story, the people they're in conflict with, the people they're going to be fighting and murdering and destroying, are each other. This is very much a civil war. This is talk about a war of between brothers, right? That's exactly what's going on here.
Is there any significance? We keep seeing, and this happens a lot in the Old Testament, and I'm not a big numerology Old Testament guy, but there are repeated patterns. And so we see 70 here pop up a couple times in the text. Is there something we need to pay attention to with that?
Yeah, we're going to see 70 again a little bit later in the story of Judges. So keep your eye on there. Generally, you know, these 40s and 70s, these numbers in Judges, they're not necessarily trying to be exact, but they're trying to be things that you're going to remember and linked to other stories. And so that is absolutely going to be the case here, as we'll see in a little bit later as well. They come and they're going to make him king. Sorry, go ahead.
No. I was just kind of, they're going to make him king. We're going to move him forward. Jotham comes into play, verse 7 through 15. And there's a level of puffing up of the falseness of this king. Because we had a dime store king in Gideon. That looks all great, like he should be a king, but he actually really isn't. Now we have Abimelech, whose daddy was the king of a kind, and who is anointed king in a physical sense. This is not a God-anointed king like the kingly line of David and Saul, which leads to Jesus. But there is a king narrative here, and so he gets put into this place, and he is quite less than pretty much every king. I think there's something to speak about there. And I think we mentioned this in our kind of prior chat to the class. We'll go ahead and throw it out here. Pay attention to the text of this. This is really the last flare-up of a time where a king gets mentioned is Abimelech as a living person doing the role until, the Judges makes one half offhand comment. Maybe pay attention to that. And then we reach until Saul really is the next one. But what happens next in the story of Abimelech that's important for us to understand?
Yeah, the biggest thing is the story is, he's going to try to kill everybody off. And every time this occurs, of course, one always gets away, right? Whether we're talking about here, with they trying to kill off the sons and Jotham gets away, or, what leads to Joash, right, when Athaliah kills off all the kids, one gets away. Or, as I always like to compare the story to, killing off all the younglings, one always gets away with Luke Skywalker, right? Mm-hmm. That's the way things work. And here, the one who gets away is Jotham. But the way that Jotham is going to get his vengeance and get his redemption is not the way we'd see it with Joash, where he becomes king himself. It's not where it's going to be with, Luke Skywalker, where he redeems his father. Instead, he's going to come and make a speech act. He's going to go out to the people, and he's going to tell them a story. He's going to invoke a curse. He tells them this, we might call it a parable, or we might call it a fable. He tells them the story about trees and about who is going to rule over the trees, right? He sets it up first, and he's like, hey, is the olive tree going to rule over you guys? And he's like, no, I'm too busy. I'd rather provide honor, than be honored. I'm one of the main diets of the Mediterranean world. I provide all sorts of valuable things. And they're like, well, what about the fig tree? Will you come rule over us? And the fig provides sweetness and wine and fresh cakes and everything else like that. It's a symbol of peace. And he's like, no, I'm not going to rule over you. And they go to the grapevine. That's another big thing. It's like, no, I'm not going to rule over you. And finally, they're like, well, we want somebody to be king, right? We got to be like all the other nations if we want to kind of combine this in with the story of Saul. So they go to a thorn bush, right, to a bramble. And he's like, we get it.
Yeah, now this is my jam.
No benefit at all to society. And this guy's a lazy layabout. He's like, oh, yeah, here, I'll be king. You other trees, you all come rest in my shade. Yeah. And then we get this awesome conclusion where Jotham really kind of brings the point home, starting verse 16, right? I don't know if we wanted to read this part or...
For sure. Let's go ahead and read verses, 16 to 20.
Sure.
Yeah. We can go ahead and start digging through the text right now.
Sure. Now, therefore... If you had acted in good faith and integrity when you made Abimelech king, and if you had dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house and had done according to his deeds as they deserved, for my father fought for you and risked his life for you and delivered you from the hand of Midian, and you have risen against my father's house this day and killed his son 70 men on one stone and made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, king over the leaders of Shechem because he is your relative, well, if then you've acted in good faith and integrity with Jerubbaal in this house to this day, then rejoice in Abimelech and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come out from Abimelech and devour the rulers and leaders of Shechem and Beth Milo. And let fire come out from the rulers of Shechem and from Beth Milo and devour Abimelech. And Jotham ran away and fled and went to Beer and lived there because of Abimelech, his brother.
So there's a whole storytelling there that leads to, especially in the way in which verses, say, 15 or so lead into this, that the bramble is going to produce the fire of the Lord that's going to burn everybody up. It comes out and it's all the cedars of Lebanon. And by the way, when he says cedars of Lebanon, the picture is all you people who want the olive tree, no. You want the fruit vine, no. You know, you want the grape, no. You get the bramble, yes. Okay, we all die. You know, that's really the synopsis of his curse. And you'll notice that the text scoots forward, and I think this is probably the quick application point, if you will. Abimelech ruled over Israel 3 years. So he was king. He couldn't wait to be king, and he ruled over Israel. It's actually something, a side note, it's one of the times where the picture goes from a small tribal section to really Israel. And so the text says Israel. But then God takes his little stir stick and begins to move things around. And so what do we make of that? Verse 23, God sent an evil spirit between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem, and the leaders of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech. I got a couple of points I think are important, or at least interesting to me. But what do you make of that interaction there?
I mean, part of this is we see the spirit a lot moving things around in the book of Judges. We've commented on it before. If you remember in the time of Gideon, of course, the spirit cloaks Gideon, or wears him like a cloak, maybe better, and brings him authority. But this is more like the evil spirit coming and getting Saul mad at David in 1 Samuel 16, or coming against David in his sin in 1 Chronicles 22 to cause him to make a census. In other words, instead of God raising up a judge to judge his people, he's raising them up each against each other to judge themselves, because nobody in the story is righteous, right? I mean, Abimelech is a murderer, and the Shechemites are like, yeah, we're cool with murder for hire as well. And God says, well, y'all just deserve each other. Let me just put my finger right here and, you know, show there's no honor among thieves.
Yeah. And it's not a surprise, because these are the kind of people that were totally cool with Abimelech coming in and taking things over. Totally chill with a second-rate king coming in and serving as the front man for their spiritual folly. So there's no surprise that, oh, these two people are bad.
Yeah, and the whole reason they're doing it is because he's more like them, right? That he's got this claim to fame that, well, I'm more like you. You know, we've seen before in the time of Deborah the connections to Genesis. And here too, right? In Genesis, we see man's supposed to leave his father's mother's house to say, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Well, here he's going to murder his father and his mother's house by appealing to his being the same bone and flesh. It's taken Adam and Eve and turning it into Cain and Abel.
Yeah. And then we have what happens next. And so I think it's kind of interesting, at least from, you know, a modern reading of the text side of things, that you have verse 26 begins with, in essence, Abimelech gets a gallstone. If you think about it, we don't even know what the word, the name gall actually means, or if there is a meaning to it beyond just being a name, although there is some likely possibilities. But what was the one that you had?
It's funny. So the closest proto-Semitic comparison we have is for the word for dung beetle.
Yeah.
So we know exactly what kind of a guy this is, right? I mean, just tip of the hand right there. He is absolutely a dung beetle.
Right. And before we get into actually even the reading of the text, it begins verse 26. I'm probably going to read 26 to 28 in just a second here. I'll read that part in a moment. There is a shift in allegiance that's going to take place as a consequence of this shift of a relationship. So where once Abimelech had the worthless men in his pocket, They go find a more worthless guy, which is another biblical story, to accomplish their ends. So beginning verse 26, and I think I'm going to read through verse 28, at least at this point. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, moved into Shechem with his relatives, and the leaders of Shechem put confidence in him. And they went out into the field and gathered the grapes from their vineyards and trod them and held a festival. Then they went into the house of their God and ate and drank and reveled Abimelech. And Gaal, the son of Ebed, said, "Who is Abimelech? And who are we of Shechem that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal? And is not Zebul his officer? Serve the men of Hamor and the father of Shechem. But why should we serve him?" I mean, there's a couple of things I noticed right away. There's the same taunting structure that, if you're familiar with the story of David and Goliath that takes place in those interactions, is the same taunting structure that is consistently shown throughout the Old Testament as the introduction to conflict. Show me your big guy and fight with me. No, you show me your big guy and fight with me. And they get all pumped up to go to war. And so there's some of that, but this is also just undercutting the balloon king that Abimelech has become.
Yeah, and just as we saw before, that Abimelech is leveraging his mother's connections to get Shechem on his side, right? That we want a king who's like us, one of our own guys, right? And you're willing to kick out someone who served you well just to have your own person in charge. Talk about tribalism, right? Here the same thing is, he's going to leverage that. Well, yeah, his mother may be, but he's really a son of Jerubbaal. And Jerubbaal is not from Shechem, unlike me, right? I'm your guy. I'm Gaal. I'm someone who you can trust to treat you well. It's like what Hal said here, that sometimes people are so starved for any leadership that they're going to accept anybody. And that's a recipe for disaster right there.
Yeah, it does not go well. And that's when in the text of this parable, they put a bramble bush in charge. You're going to get scraped up. I mean, it's just like, that's the image is like super Lando obvious in that text. But then there's some deeper things that take place. You think back again to the spiritual significance of Shechem. If you didn't note it, they've already got their own Baal or Baal treasure trove set up. It's not just like a few people are holdouts. They go in the treasury, they pay. Okay, now they go back to it again. And that's also a part of the reason I will suggest that this dig or diss or shade is thrown about him being the one who contends with Baal. Yeah. The son of the one who contends with Baal, the king maker, if you will. And so they're really making this, and this is something I think is a great point to include in here, at least as I see that. Everyone who participates in the Old Testament stories, for the most part, as far as I can reckon all of them, they're not agnostics, nor are they atheists. They are all believers. They either believe in the gods of their own people, or they believe in Jehovah and eventually his son. And when these conflicts take place, we always have to be aware of that, because there's a couple of things that are really important for us. These false gods, we tend to think of them as powerless. But there is absolute power, regardless of how you want to quantify the source of it, whether it's otherworldly or not, because it certainly could be ascribed to the devil and his work. But the people follow. They follow with devotion to the point of death. So they believe just as much as we ought to believe. And so this conflict that includes these spiritual overtones should not be like subjugated to like, oh, that's not a thing. It's totally a thing. And it rises up a couple of times very plainly in the second painful half of Judges. So what else are we seeing here? We kind of scooch into the next part of the story where, say, verses 30 through 41, 30 through 49 range, there's a power struggle that takes place to see who's going to come out on top.
Yeah, and it's a comedy of errors in a lot of ways, right? Like, everybody's just dumb in the way they do things, right? I mean, they're getting everybody psyched up, and Abimelech finds out. He's like, oh, we're going to go and ambush them, right? And he splits his people up at night, sends them into four different groups. It kind of reminds us of Gideon's attack, right? Yep. Except they're so bad at it that even the super drunk guy, you know, Gaal's like, wait, are those like enemies coming and sneaking up on me? And he's like, no, you're just looking at shadows. You know, don't worry about that sort of a thing, right? And again, he's like, no, I think there's like bad guys coming. He's like, well, go and attack them, big shot, right? And they're routed, and a bunch of people die at the gate before they can even make it into the city. And Abimelech is like, well, look, I've done well. But instead of occupying the city, he's taken the gate, and he's like, no, I'm going to go and leave. I'm going to go home to Arumah. Like, these are stupid tactical decisions, yeah. Right? And they think, oh, it's done, and we're going to go back to our lives in verse 42, but that's not how it works either. You know, it just keeps getting dumber and dumber in some ways.
Yeah, if you want to see some weird intertextual flip-flopping, here you have the sober Abimelech who is making the foolish decisions, and the actually drunk Gallstone who's making the smart decisions. And if you move forward in the text of the story of another king we've already highlighted and kind of hinted at, David, the probably sober king, makes stupid, foolish decisions in regards to Bathsheba. And this is not baby David. This is full-grown King David who does this. In contrast to his chief officer, who tries to get drunk to do dumb things, and he doesn't do the dumb things.
Yeah.
And so there's some great kind of contrasting narrative elements here that also all of them have the hand of God swooshing the waters left and right.
So he finally comes back right there in verse 42. He's able to take the city, even though they realize it's an ambush. He takes the gatehouse. He sees his inhabitants. He raises the city, right, like burns it. And we're like, oh, man, there's that first curse coming across that Jotham had said, may fire come out and consume Shechem if you did this from a bad heart, which we know they did. And that's occurring already. And then he, you know, salts the ground, and it's not like he's got enough salt to permanently destroy the soil. It seems to be ritual in that sort of way. But there's a holdout, right? That there's a tower, a defensible structure, and people are hiding out there. And this tower is actually the shrine, right? This is the temple tower for Baal Berit, the one that's given Abimelech the money to hire his army, and the one that's given Gaal the money to hire his army. And he's going to set fire to it. And then he moves on to Thebez, and this is just kind of the climax of the story in terms of what's going on there. But before we jump into that part, did you have anything you wanted to kind of highlight before we get to that point?
No, I think we've got a good, pictorial understanding. Just remember this, just like in the narratives of destruction when Joshua was leading Israel into Canaan, just like when Moses led Israel up to the edge of the Promised Land, the descriptions of the battle there are bold and plainful. They're bloody and awful. And it's intentional. Like, at least as I read the text, it's planned, inspired instruction for us to learn from. We'll try to draw some application, by the way, to that as we close out Abimelech's story in just a minute. That brings us to verse 50, and I think it's probably good for us to read this last section, 50 to 57. Jared, do you want to read for us?
Then Abimelech went to Thebez and camped against Thebez and captured it. But there was a strong tower within the city there too, and all the men and the women and all the leaders of the city fled to it and shut themselves in, and they went up to the roof of the tower. And Abimelech came to the tower, and he fought against it, and he drew near to the door of the tower to burn it with fire. And then a random woman threw a millstone on Abimelech's head and crushed his temple. And then he called quickly to the young man, his armor bearer, and said to him, draw your sword and you kill me. Otherwise, they're going to say a woman killed him. And his young man thrust him through and he died. And then the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead and everyone departed to his home. And in this way, God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he had committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads. And upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal.
So a couple things I think are important for me to catch before we break down the text a little bit more. Note that God's hand is all over this section. Everything that happens, including The end of Abimelech is all part of God's overarching theme. Whereas in some books of the Old Testament, it's harder to identify when God moves. In this part of Judges, he's beating the winds and lifting the sails of the ships that float around on that sea. So what's important here? There's a lot that goes on. There's some really important sections about Shechem, about Abimelech. But what do we need to know so we can draw some good applications from this text?
I mean, the first thing is just to kind of continue the connections you've been making between Saul and David, right? Is that, remember, how does David get, Uriah killed? He sends him up against the tower, and it's like, well, nobody just draws near to the gate. But again, here this guy is, who should know better. He's like going to run up to the tower, and he's going to get killed, right? The same sort of thing that's happening before is going to happen to him here as well. And notice how he's killed, right? He's like Saul, where he's wounded and doesn't want to have the shame of his death being something else, so he gets killed by his own armor bearer. But there's more to it, too, because he's struck in the temple. Now, we've seen this before.
Yeah, I brought the funnel and the ring up for us, and so we've got both of those.
So one of the things about this funnel and the ring that we've been talking about before is it helps us notice things we might not otherwise notice. In other words, it should sensitize us to some things and show that this is clearly intentional by God's inspired author. So who are we supposed to connect the story of Abimelech to?
Well, with Abimelech, you've got a couple of things that are important. In the text, it bounces back to Deborah and Barak with some of the contextual setting and what happens to Gideon and that whole end of his life structure. I mean, and we've got the tie-in there to chapter 4, verse 21, chapter 5, verse 26 with Jael. I think the women aspect of it is important for us to pay attention to. I think, as we pointed out a couple classes ago, a couple studies ago, the one gets nailed, the other one gets stoned. I think there's some point to that, that their demise, and I want to slide this slide up one more edge of it. It's not just that women do it, it's that God moved the women to do that. He moved the puzzle pieces, he moved the chess pieces around to accomplish this in the way that nobody would expect when the story is being told.
Yeah, and this is even ramped up a little bit, right? Because just as Jael kills Sisera with a tent peg, which isn't really a real weapon, into his temple, now we have it even worse. It's an unnamed woman, just some random woman, right? And she just throws a rock. I mean, the way I've envisioned this in my head is, right, she's like closing her eyes and just like dumps it over the side, you know. It's not like she's aiming for him, right? Just a roof tile, whatever she can grab. It's not an arrow. It's not a spear. She's not like gunning for this guy. She just kind of dumps it over the side. And here, just as it was shameful for Sisera to be killed by this heroic Jael, here he's killed by some random woman. In the same way, by being struck in the head, we're obviously supposed to connect these stories, that he is a Sisera of sorts, right? Where Sisera had longed to kill men and rape women, we saw that before in verse 49 that he had burned a tower that had 1,000 men and women in it. It just kills them all. Doesn't worry about that, right? So we see here that this Israelite king has become like Sisera.
Yeah.
And even worse.
I think it's important to notice as well is that the conflict has shifted from looking outward to looking inward. That's why you see in all of these dynamics that from, say, chapter 1, all the way to the middle point of Gideon's story, it's all about paganism as the conflict. When Gideon gets over the hump of success and goes into his demise, he goes into paganism. And Abimelech never leaves it. He doesn't leave it. We're not quite sure what to do with some of the upcoming stories. You got Samson, who is the frat bro of the text of Judges. We can call him Chad if we want to. But that's a story that shifts to its demise in the text. So this is another way to think about this overall passage is to realize that Israel is now pretty much Canaan, this Israel. We don't know where Boaz and Ruth and all that's taking place in the story. They're a holdout, if you will. They're the remnant, which is another theological principle from the big stories of the Bible.
Yeah, I mean, and just, you know, just so we know we're not just kind of making this up, there's a lot of other connections even between here and the story with Deborah and Barak and them too. I mean, these are the only two major narratives that we don't have a specific judge mentioned. You know, in both cases, they have a narrative, a prose account, and then also like some sort of poetry or fable included. These are both set in the northern tribes. I mean, there's all these little things that that is showing something I think that's really important, and that is that God is very intentional with his inspiration to write not just true stories, but good stories, yeah. Right? He's writing not just history. He's also writing excellent literature. And that if we miss out on that, then we're missing some of the things that God clearly wants us to pick up on. And I think that's important.
Yeah, there's a... Again, this is just the way that I picture it. It's grandpa teaching grandchild on the riverside. These are stories designed to move you towards an understanding of who God is. They're structured, they're organized, they're planned because they're inspired. And it should not be a surprise that they're so neatly woven together. Let's go ahead and actually cover chapter 10, verses 1 through 5. And then we'll pause and make some application as the last part of the text and class. So there are two individuals that will also follow this model. We're going to go ahead and read verses 1 through 5 together and kind of pay attention to that. So chapter 10, verses 1 and following. After Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Pua, the son of Dodo, a man of Issachar. And he lived at Shemir, in the hill country of Ephraim, and he judged Israel 23 years. Then he died and was buried at Shamir. After him arose Jair the Gileadite, who judged Israel 22 years. And he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, and they had 30 cities, called Havath Jair to this day, which are in the land of Gilead. And Jair died and was buried at Kamon. So you get like five verses to cover two judges who are slightly less than each other in some ways, but different than each other's. If you notice, 23 years, 22 years, slightly less. You know, nobody can read the Son of Dodo without smiling. That's just a normal thing. But what's going on with them? What do we need to pay attention to with the seventh and eighth potential judges of Israel?
Yeah, these are guys they're acting like kings, right? I mean, they're just like Gideon. They've got large harems. They've got lots of kids. They've got high status stuff. We don't read anything that they really do that helps Israel, right? In the same way, we don't read anything that Abimelech does that helps Israel. I mean, you can even feel the irony there in verse 1, right? Then after Abimelech, there rose to save. Well, what do they do to save Israel? Nothing we read about. Right now, that doesn't mean that there's nothing there, but God's given us what's most important, and that is they are acting like kings.
Yeah,
so
I think
again, they may say they're not going to be, but they are.
Right. I think it's interesting to note that there's a shift from God anointed, God raised, to there arose to save mm-hmm. Israel. And so the reading of the tone is important. Their names, Tola is... Was that worm?
Or to hang, something like
yeah.
that.
But the regions they're from, Ephraim is supposed to be a mighty tribe, but they don't really have that great power that they seem to potentially possess. And in all of this, and there's also that repeated 30 sons, 30 donkeys, and 30 cities. Again, how much of a warlord can you be, would be something I think is important. So, we got about 5 or 6 minutes left in our scheduled class time. I think there's two big lessons that I want to bring out, but before we get that, especially if you're listening or, haven't had a chance to comment yet, if there's something you like in the text or a question you have, go ahead and drop a comment in the chat box there. We'll try to bring that in and talk about it a little bit. But Jared, right here in chapter 9, what's the most interesting thing to you in the ninth chapter of Judges? Like, you like it or not, it's just interesting.
just seeing what people will do and how quickly they're willing to sacrifice people who've helped them in the past if they think they can get any little benefit from it. Right? Yeah. I mean, that seems to be what's going on here. It's like, hey, I'll treat you nicer than all these other people. Why don't you just commit 70 murders? And they're like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about abandoning principles for profit immediately. It's just that to me is terrifying, but that's where we have it, right?
Yeah, you got Amos and Habakkuk, the prophets of the end of the Old Testament narratives and Old Testament instructional sections who condemn deeply Israel for this same kind of self-serving behavior. I find it really interesting that there's so much literary connection in this chapter to everything that's about to happen. You can see those things. It's kind of like seeing the Matrix. Like, I can see all the math that goes underneath the stuff when you see that. And I find that really interesting. But what's important for us to learn here? I think it's like the spiritual lesson side of things. What are some of the things that you look at and you go, okay, now I know more about God and I know more about people. You've already talked about one of the people factors, but what do we learn about God here?
That God's not going to be mocked first and foremost. And that even if we don't see God raising up a savior, a judge, a warlord, that doesn't mean he's not working behind the scenes. And sometimes the leader we get is the leader we deserve, and we deserve to be destroyed, right? I mean, that's exactly what happens here. God is like, fine, Abimelech, go for it. But I'm going to use you to destroy my people, and I'm going to use my people to destroy you. That all this enmity between them, that is God's actions to judge both of them. That's, I mean, you know, there's God for you right there.
Yeah, I think Judges 9:56, God requited is the old King James text there. You know, return the evil. I kind of like requite when you're dealing with these old Western looking texts. And it really, you know, it's a payment. They earned it. It was a wage for the evil of their days. And so I think that's something we learn about God, that God does care. And his response is going to be equivalent to the circumstance, not what we think it is, but what it genuinely is. Right. I will also add this, and it kind of ties together with Hal's comment as well that he dropped earlier. Abimelech had no real spiritual interest, kind of like Esau. Esau is a great companion to that. And then he took everything that was offered to him. And the irony of selling it all for a bowl of soup is never lost on me.
Cincinnati chili. It was real good.
I had to admit, like, but I want to add one more layer to that. How often do we, in essence, make the same short-sighted decision where, I want to just do it right now. And so let me just cut a little edge off here or move a little bit small or big towards the tableau of wickedness in order to engage in what we wanted to do, whether it's lust, destruction, vengeance, greed, name off your seven deadly sins. They all fit there. Deep spiritual pain takes place. There's great connection to the text of Romans, both chapters 1-3, but also chapter 8 verses 5-10 to pay attention to, in addition to everything that's going to happen. So we've got ahead for us, I think we're going to be theoretically spending two sessions. And Mark Russell tells us the truth that cinnamon does not belong in chili.
As long as you recognize it's not chili, it's something different. Cincinnati chili is really good. Those conies, man, oh, so good. I miss Gold Star. I do. I miss Gold Star.
So let me add this. You know, we've got two classes coming up that we planned out for both Sunday and Wednesday. We're going to split the story of Jephthah because it's a big story and there's a lot that goes on with that over the next two sessions. That'll include the run up here in chapter 10, verse 6. So please look forward to that. We're thankful for your participation in this. We realize that an online Bible like study like this is kind of odd. It's odd for the two of us, although we've gotten better at it over the last couple of weeks. But
it's the hope.
We think so. That's all that matters.
The delusion.
Yeah, the delusion of it all. the facade of success. But we want to also encourage you in a couple of ways. As we study through the text of Judges, it is a mess, and yet God finds a way in the same time frame to lay the foundation for redemption. A redemption found in Jesus, a redemption found in the kingdom, a redemption found in a reconciled relationship with Jehovah. And Jared and I are happy to talk to anyone about that, and we certainly want people to lean into spiritual things. If you have questions for us about Judges, questions about God, drop us a message. We'd be happy to talk to you about it. But we'll close out now with an opportunity to pray. And if everyone would bow their heads together, we're going to pray the best we can. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day. We thank you for the privilege it is to dig into your word and the special opportunity that we have to study. We ask that especially tonight that you would watch over the souls of so many that we know that are suffering in the flesh and they're suffering in their hearts. There are many who are struggling to make decisions about the care of their loved ones, to make decisions about the leadership of the churches they're part of, and the directions they will go. When we look through the text of Judges, leadership seems to exist as an idea and in no practical way. And so it's our hope that you help lead us to you and to your Son. Give us wisdom and give us strength. And this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. Amen. Thanks, everybody.